Middleboro, WRSLP, Pittsfield, WLLO, Londonderry, WVALLP, FL, WDJF, Framingham.
Okay, let's begin the reading of today's Boston Globe. It's Friday, the 10th of July, 2026, and we say hello to Pam and Pamela.
Hi, this is Pam.
And this is Pamela.
I'm on the front page.
City transportation planner killed on bike. Woman who helped guide the blue bike policy hit by a truck on Tremont Street. Louisa Gagg was an enthusiastic cyclist, regularly riding the winding streets of Boston. Her passion extended to her professional life, where she worked in City Hall as a bike share and transportation planner to improve safety and accessibility on those very same roadways. On Thursday morning, Gagg was riding near Roxbury Crossing, an area known for its heavy and high-speed traffic, when she was fatally struck by the driver of a truck on Tremont Street, authorities said. The crash has sent shockwaves through the cycling community, where advocates recalled her effusive joy and wide-ranging impact. And it also hit close to home in City Hall, where Gagg had been an intern for Mayor Michelle Wu when she was a city councilor. Wu said that the 36-year-old will be remembered as a bright light and dedicated public servant. "Our hearts are with her family, friends, colleagues, and all whose lives she touched," Wu said in a statement. "I am absolutely devastated by this unfathomable loss for our community and our city." Gagg began working for Wu as a policy fellow when the latter was a city councilor and quickly became a trusted colleague and partner, the mayor recalled in her statement. "She led programs and improvements that made our streets safer, our community stronger, and our residents' daily lives better." "Her legacy," Wu said, "will endure in the work she advanced across the city and in the commitment of her colleagues, friends, and fellow advocates to carry it forward." The crash occurred a short distance from the Southwest Corridor Park. The driver stopped afterward, officials said. The circumstances of Thursday's crash were not immediately clear. Suffolk District Attorney Kevin Hayden said his office is investigating, along with the Boston Police. "The investigation of Louisa's tragic death is underway and will be thorough and careful," Hayden said. The area of the crash has been a source of concern and frustration for cycling safety advocates in recent years. "We all know how dangerous Tremont Street is, said Stephanie Codgel, interim executive director of the Boston Cyclists Union, which has an office near the scene. She and others expressed both grief and anger. "Louisa is such a loved and tight member of our community. For this to happen where it did just adds insult to injury." The tragedy also occurred during a time when some transit advocates have criticized Wu for stalling a number of street improvement projects they said that would improve public safety. One such area that's been targeted for improvement is the busy intersection at Roxbury Crossing, a few blocks from the crash scene. Wu has said that street safety remains a priority for her administration and emphasized that work on many such infrastructure projects are ongoing. In 2025, there were 256 crashes in Boston that resulted in a cyclist being injured, according to the city's Vision Zero database, which relies on data from Boston Emergency Medical Services. No fatalities were reported. Data on crashes involving cyclists in the city was not available. The Cyclists Union on Wednesday renewed its call for Wu to unpause the projects that will provide needed safety to prevent these deaths, which don't have to happen, Codgel said. Meanwhile, Boston City Councilor Sharon Durkin, whose district includes Roxbury Crossing, and also who chairs the Chamber's Planning, Development, and Transportation Committee, demanded the city fast-track safety infrastructure in the wake of Louisa Gagg's death on Thursday. "We cannot stand by and watch more fatalities happen on our streets," Durkin said. Gagg was raised by civically engaged parents and was a graduate of Boston Latin School, friends and family said. Before joining the city in 2022, she worked for Livable Streets Alliance, a Boston-based nonprofit that pushes for increased safety, equity, and affordability. Stacy Thompson hired her at a time when the organization was small. They grew with it together and became fast friends. "Her spark was immediately apparent," Thompson said. Gag was the original author of the nonprofit's progress reports on Vision Zero, a global movement that Boston committed to more than a decade ago. The strategy is aimed at eliminating traffic fatalities and severe injuries by focusing on safe mobility for all road users. She was responsible for listing the names of the people who had died as a result of crashes in the city. "It is unimaginably hard to add her name to that list," Thompson said. Gag left advocacy to work at City Hall because she believed fundamentally in the civic duty of the city. She desired to make real change, and she did, Thompson added. A big part of her work centered around expanding the bike share program, Blue Bikes, and encouraging more people to use bicycles. She was effective everywhere she went, capable of gaining trust among advocates, community members, and people in positions of power. People could tell that she cared. "It wasn't just a job for her," said Thompson, who added that Gag's contributions could not be summed up in a single accomplishment. "There are streets that you cross that are safer because of Louisa. She is in the fabric of this city. The only thing we can do, which she would want us to do, is to move forward and to move faster." Galen Mook, executive director of Mass Bike, collaborated with Gag for more than a decade on efforts to improve the safety of roadways in Boston, calling her a champion of the work. "She showed up to everything, from celebrations to hard conversations, and always did so with a smile." Another bike safety advocate and friend of hers, Peter Chung, said that the community plans on holding a memorial for Gag after family and community members have a chance to grieve. "For years, he has organized ghost bike installations at the scene of cyclist fatalities to remember those who were killed. But this is as close as it has hit to home for everyone," Chung said.
Unsettled Democrats in Maine press on. For so many Democrats across Maine, seemingly every hour since late Monday afternoon has carried waves of intense emotion. Heartbreak, anger, regret, validation, confusion, all felt, sometimes several of them simultaneously, since the dramatic collapse of Senate hopeful Graham Plattner. That seismic development, set into motion this week by a political story Monday afternoon in which a former girlfriend accused Plattner of rape, has reshaped Maine's nationally watched Senate contest in the most direct way possible. Maine Democrats must now put forward a new nominee to challenge Republican Senator Susan Collins. The debacle could disrupt the race on a more fundamental level. In interviews with nearly a dozen Maine Democrats, from high-level officials to regular voters, it's clear the emotion stirred by the Plattner saga will linger for some time and will even define how quickly the party can move forward. Since launching his campaign last year, Plattner, a first-time candidate, improbably built perhaps the most impressive grassroots campaign movement in modern Maine history. It weathered the successive scandals that piled up on him from the beginning, powering him past establishment-backed Governor Janet Mills, and ultimately to secure 72% of the vote in the state primary in June. Many enthusiastic Plattner supporters are deeply disappointed, and some share his view, expressed in a defiant video he posted Wednesday night, that it was not a credible allegation of sexual assault, but the entrenched political system responsible for his demise. "I hate what the system did to him," said William Bram, a retired photographer, who spoke to the Globe near Plattner's former headquarters in Ellsworth. "I wish he would have stayed in the race even with zero support and let the chips fall where they might. He had the right message." Others are reckoning with their own embrace of the problematic candidate. "It's a painful time for those of us who supported Graham," said Tricia Cesar, 63, of Newcastle. "I cried when the political article came out. I was frustrated and sad. Sad that he did that to somebody. Sad that he would deny it. Sad that it came up yet again. I'm very disappointed that Graham Plattner turned out to be this person," added Gabrielle LaSalle, a 23-year-old Portland resident. "Like, should I have figured this out much sooner? I mean, what kind of guy gets a tattoo like that?" He said, referring to the tattoo of a Nazi symbol Plattner had on his chest that became one of his early flashpoints. The minority of Maine Democrats who did not get behind Plattner in the primary, and perhaps were always skeptical of the self-styled populist hero, are sorting through the mix of emotions that comes with having seen the red flags in his background that only became obvious to others under the most dire of circumstances. "I'm trying not to engage in a lot of 'I told you so.' It kind of goes without saying," said David Morris, the mayor of Westbrook, who endorsed Mills during the primary. "I want to look forward to what's next." Most Maine Democrats agree that what's next Picking a new candidate to take on Collins is the obvious strategic imperative. That process is hard enough on paper, largely because it has never been required in a statewide race of this significance in living memory. If Plattner officially withdraws by Monday night, as expected, the Maine Democratic Party will have until July 27th to put forward a replacement. A number of candidates have declared their intent to run, while the party is planning for a convention of some 600 delegates to decide which will be the nominee. But the profoundly disrupted political landscape left in Plattner's wake will make that process even harder. He and his allies have sniped back and forth with the state party, while different factions have sought to lay down markers for what, to them, would be the fairest method to pick a new candidate. The would-be successors, meanwhile, are all appealing to Plattner's supporters, while conspicuously trying to distance themselves from the man himself. Taken together, few in Maine politics have ever seen anything like it. Former two-term Maine Governor John Baldacci, who was first elected to Bangor City Council in 1978, said the moment is unprecedented. "I have never seen Maine politics in a situation like this before," he said in an interview. "And while I appreciate all the national attention on us, we have a lot of work to do." It's not only Democrats' heads that are spinning, it's also Republicans. The GOP would have been happy to face a damaged Plattner in November, said Chuck Ellis, the chairman of the Cumberland County Republican Party. Among other controversies before the political story, Plattner was facing scrutiny on his past relationships with women, detailed in a troubling New York Times report. "The situation," said Ellis, "doesn't just reflect poorly on Plattner. It reflects poorly on Maine Democrats who embraced him. If the world was just, it should hurt them in the election in November," he said. Even if Plattner is replaced with a candidate carrying far less baggage, the debacle may well continue to haunt Democrats in the fall. But the deeper hurt of feeling burned by Plattner, in one way or another, was the top of mind for many Democrats this week. And there's a sense of mourning for what was, despite the controversies, a special movement. At one point, Plattner's campaign boasted a staggering 15,000 volunteers across the state, roughly 1% of the entire population of Maine. The walls of his primary night party were filled with homemade campaign signs. Just over a week ago, Tig Filson welcomed more than 300 people to her backyard in Cumberland for a town hall to support Plattner. Filson, 40, didn't hesitate when she was asked to host. Since she had first met Plattner at a coffee shop meet and greet back in February, she had found him inspiring. "He was just so laser-focused on sitting with people and answering hard questions," she said. "There was a fearlessness that I just sort of loved and found really compelling." "People left the gathering feeling inspired," Filson said. "The feedback that I got was that this guy can get the job done. He can beat Susan." 5 days later, Filson was on a work call when she saw a push notification about the rape allegation. "My heart just sank," she said. Now, she's left feeling angry and has come to view Plattner's decision to run, given his past, as being fueled by arrogance and the expectation of women would remain silent about sexual assault. "One of the hardest moments," she said, "was having to tell her 10-year-old daughter, who had just helped out at the Plattner's event, about the accusation." Looking ahead, Filson said, she's hoping for someone who can authentically carry the movement forward. Are they able to carry forward the goals of this movement, but also make it their own? That's one of the biggest questions hovering over the murky path forward. Several of the leading contenders ran in the gubernatorial primary, and while they fell short, have genuine followings, including former State Senate leader Troy Jackson, Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, and former Maine COVID response leader Nirav Shah. None commanded the grassroots pull Plattner did, but by echoing his focus on the cost of living concerns of Mainers and their exasperation with the status quo, some Democrats believe they can come close. Ryan Fecteau, the Democratic Speaker of the Maine House, observed that many Plattner supporters felt they were finally hearing from someone who's addressing the key issues they feel in their everyday lives. But he also argued there's increasing understanding that while Plattner was an effective communicator, he doesn't have a unique claim on his platform. "I fully acknowledge the hurt and pain that people really felt like this was a once-in-a-lifetime candidate," Fecteau added. "But the cost of sitting out or disengaging," he predicted, "would be too high for most Democrats to bear with control of the U.S. Senate on the line." "People are turning to us across the nation saying, 'Maine, please get this right,'" he said. "I think Maine people will dust off their jeans, look at the task at hand, and get it done."
World Cup, half full,
half empty. Foxborough residents reflect on the crafts and lessons from the tournament. It's game day, and like he has for the past 37 years, Cal Davis is waiting for you to drive onto his lawn and pay cash for the privilege. His house is situated a little more than 1 mile from where, in a few hours' time, tens of thousands of fans would take in the last local game of this World Cup. A 70-year-old semi-retired cabinet maker, Davis operates a private parking lot at his North Street home. Just past noontime Thursday, about half a dozen cars had parked in his yard at $100 each, and he was waiting for more fans to show up. Like everyone else in the neighborhood, he has thoughts about the nearby Gillette Stadium and its owners, about the hassles and the quirks of game days and concerts and general revelry the stadium brings. Davis had expected the worst from this World Cup, namely unimaginable traffic congestion, but he's been impressed with how smoothly things have gone. Trains to the stadium have worked well. Fans have also planned ahead of time, booking large vans or buses to Gillette or thereabouts. For Davis, it shows that the region can take big events in stride. "I really hope it opens it up for a possible Super Bowl here," he said. In this part of town, large-scale events are an accepted part of life. Locals know to avoid nearby Route 1, where Gillette is packed. They take back roads, many of which are closed to all but local residents. Checkpoints on residential side streets are staffed by police officers, sheriff deputies, and sometimes even public works employees to prevent randos from parking wherever they please. The relationship between the town, its residents, and the stadium, and its ownership, which is spearheaded by Robert Kraft, can be a complicated one. Indeed, Foxborough and Kraft are currently embroiled in a legal fight over public safety costs associated with events at the venue. Just this week, the town asked a judge to dismiss a lawsuit brought by the Kraft's family company, arguing his company, not local taxpayers, is contractually obligated to pay those public safety costs. Kraft Sports and Entertainment LLC and the New England Patriots sued the town in Norfolk Superior Court last month, accusing Foxborough officials of improperly using the stadium's annual entertainment license renewal to impose nearly $1 million in charges that are not authorized under state law. For some here in Foxborough, the Crafts are elitists who do what they want with little consideration for the town's needs. Critics say anytime they don't get what they want, they threaten legal action. The relationship between the Crafts and the town of Foxborough has improved over the years. However, they're bullies, plain and simple, said Bert Delaney, a 58-year-old high school principal and former town selectman who grew up here. For Delaney, any and all costs related to events at the stadium should be paid by the Crafts. He is curious, when the dust has settled from this World Cup, to see what the net gain for the town is after it hosted 7 games of the international tournament. "That's what I want to know," he said over the phone this week. He's not alone in his criticism of Kraft. Some residents think the sports mogul could and should do more for Foxborough, whether giving the town more money, hiring more of its residents at the stadium, or even offering to pay for the paving of a certain number of town streets each year. "When he snaps his fingers, he wants the town to jump," said Paul Morrison, a 68-year-old retired correction officer who has lived in Foxborough since 1998. "I don't think it should be that way." To be sure, not everyone in Foxborough feels that way. The stadium, home to the 6-time Super Bowl champion New England Patriots, which Kraft also owns, gives the town much of its identity. Without it, Foxborough could just be another locale in a seemingly endless sea of suburbia in the southeast part of the state. He does do some positive things for the town. Frank Zaloza, a 70-year-old North Street resident and retired software developer, said of Kraft. Indeed, Kraft Sports, an entertainment spokeswoman, Anisha Chakrabarty, said in a Thursday statement that the partnership between the town and the stadium ownership has transformed Gillette and the surrounding Patriot Place shopping area into a year-round destination that generates millions of dollars for the town annually, supports local businesses, creates thousands of jobs, and has put Foxborough on the global stage. Chakrabarty also ticked off how much money the ownership group pays to the town. Between 2023 and 2025, Gillette Stadium and its affiliates paid approximately $42 million to the town. In 2025 alone, total payments to the town exceeded $14.9 million, including more than $4 million for police, fire, and EMS detail services, she said. The jobs, tax revenue, local spending, infrastructure investments, charitable support, and international visibility associated with Gillette Stadium have become part of the fabric of the community, and they are the result of sustained private investment and a strong partnership with the town, she said. Back on North Street, John Powers thinks that the Crafts have a point with the lawsuit. A 76-year-old who still works part-time at the horse track at Plain Ridge Park, Powers has lived in Foxborough for 31 years. During Patriots games, you can hear the roar of the crowd from his backyard. If the crowd is going nuts, you know that things are going well for the home team. If there is silence, there are likely problems for the Patriots. His main beef currently is not with the Crafts, but with the town. Like Davis, his neighbor down the street, Powers parks cars at his property for events. But unlike Davis, he doesn't have a license to do so. When he inquired about getting one, he was told that his property wasn't zoned properly. During one recent World Cup match, he was dinged with fines, $100 for every car over 10 on his property, for $400 in total. It's irritating, he said. Residents in this neighborhood have all kinds of stories and anecdotes related to events at the stadium. Skinny dippers using a neighbor's pool for a late-night swim after a concert, buoyant fans urinating in their front yard after a big game, youths emerging from woods near the stadium, bewildered and lost, women walking barefoot along Route 1 after Country Fest with their feet all cut up. The World Cup has also brought vignettes of joy to the neighborhood. One Haitian family threw a huge barbecue and welcomed kilted Scots off the street to dig into plates of rice and beans before the two nations faced off. Outside the stadium before another game, Norwegians and Iraqis formed a circle and juggled a soccer ball together. Davis has been parking people at his home for stadium events since a Grateful Dead concert in 1989. His lot is licensed. He has liability insurance for the parking operation and had to submit a schematic of his yard to obtain a necessary permit. He's required to offer toilets for his parking patrons and be trained in first aid and how to administer Narcan. He is among those who think the town has benefited from Kraft. He's done so much and people expect so much more, he said. All in all, he enjoys living near the stadium. I like the energy, and you can't help but be a football fan.
U.S. and Iran exchange more attacks. Tit-for-tat fire appears bigger from both sides. The United States launched new airstrikes against Iran early Thursday, and Tehran responded by targeting U.S.-allied Mideast countries in exchange of fire that threatened an interim deal intended to help end war in the Middle East. Back-and-forth attacks, including a day earlier, have repeatedly threatened the ceasefire. But Thursday's appeared bigger all around, with sirens sounding at least three times in Bahrain, home to the U.S. Navy's 5th Fleet headquarters, and missiles targeting Kuwait and Qatar. Sirens sounded Thursday afternoon in Jordan as well. The United States has stationed troops and aircraft. An Iranian official accused the United States of launching an airstrike later Thursday, targeting the area around Iran's sole nuclear power plant, and other explosions were reported elsewhere in the country during the afternoon. The strike came hours after President Trump said recent Iranian attacks on ships in the Strait of Hormuz signaled the end of a fragile ceasefire and threatened to escalate the conflict if they didn't stop. That raised concerns the region could tip back into a war that would engulf several countries and could halt energy shipments in a strait that are crucial for the global economy. In Iran, the 2 days of U.S. airstrikes have killed at least 14 people and wounded another 78, Iran's health ministry said Thursday. Many were reportedly members of the armed forces. In Kuwait, military said falling debris wounded one person as the nation shot down 3 ballistic missiles, a cruise missile, and 10 drones. Bahrain said it shot down incoming fire without elaborating. And Jordanian government spokesman Mohammed Al-Mamami said all incoming fire from Iran had been intercepted. Iranian state TV said the country's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard fired missiles at a U.S. base in Jordan. There was no immediate word of damage in Qatar. The U.S. Military Central Command said it hit 90 targets across Iran, releasing black and white footage of what appeared to be strikes on airport runway and missile launchers. The United States said the strikes were intended to further degrade Iran's ability to threaten freedom of navigation in the strait, which through a fifth of the world's traded oil and natural gas pass before the war began with the U.S. and Israeli attacks on February 28th. Traffic has picked up somewhat since a tentative deal last month that included opening the waterway. Maritime data company Lloyd's List Intelligence said Thursday that preliminary data showed at least 576 ships passed through the strait in June, compared with 233 in May. More than 3,100 transited the strait in June 2025. During the conflict, attacks on ships and the threat of such strikes virtually halted traffic in the watery, making oil prices skyrocket and raising the cost of food and other basic goods far beyond the region. On Thursday, Iranian state media reported explosions in several locations, including Bushehr, home to Iran's nuclear power plant complex, and southern port cities. The state-run IRNA news agency quoted Ehsan Jahanian, a local official in Bushehr, as accusing the United States of striking near the plant around noon, hours after Central Command said it ended its latest round of strikes in Iran. Asked for a comment on Bushehr, Central Command referred to a press release that detailed targets but made no mention of the nuclear power plant. During the war, several strikes hit the area around the plant but didn't damage it. For the first time since April, U.S. strikes also appeared to target Iranian bridges. State media report a strike on a railway bridge in Iran's northeastern Golestan province, and the Revolutionary Guard said two bridges were attacked on the route to Mashhad, where officials planned to bury the late Ayatollah Ali Khamenei on Thursday. After leaving a NATO summit in Turkey, Trump posted several videos on his social media site of what he said were explosions in Iran and issued another warning to the Islamic Republic. This is in retribution for yesterday's bombing of ships by Iran. If it happens again, it will get much worse, Trump wrote Wednesday, a day after three tankers were attacked in the Strait of Hormuz. Parliament Speaker Mohammed Bagar Kalibaf, a key negotiator in talks seeking a permanent end to the war, was defiant in a post on X on Thursday morning. America still hasn't learned that bullying and breaking promises are no longer cost-free. Let me put it plainly, if you strike, you'll get hit. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said he spoke by phone with his Saudi, Turkish, and Omani counterparts, and with Pakistan's Army Chief, Field Marshal Asim Munir, who had been one of the main mediators in the war. The diplomatic outreach suggested efforts may be underway to reduce tensions. Trump fueled concerns that the war could restart by saying Wednesday that the interim agreement to pause the fighting was over. He added that he would allow negotiations to continue, but thought negotiators were wasting their time. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Kazem Garababadi, also a top negotiator, retorted on X that Trump's remarks are not a sign of power, but an admission of the failure of U.S. policy toward Iran. Negotiations to reach a final deal were due to start after the days-long funeral for Khamenei, who was killed in the war's first months.
Vast AI boom targets Native American land. Tech firms seek space for massive data centers. Seminole, Oklahoma. Since its casino closed in 2017, the Caddo Nation, an hour west of Oklahoma City, has struggled. So some Caddo leaders see only hope in the data center boom. We're not poor, Bobby Gonzalez, the Caddo chair, said. We're broke. But in Binger, Oklahoma, home of baseball legend and Choctaw, Johnny Bench, Gonzalez bumped into Tracy Newcomet, a former tribal council member who felt differently about a future tied to big tech. She could live without a cell phone, she said as she prepared for the Caddo's traditional turkey dance, but not without water, maybe the biggest concern for data center development in Indian country. The dizzying expansion of data centers to power artificial intelligence has communities in Republican and Democratic states feeling blindsided as citizens and local governments are forced to grapple with noise, water, and energy concerns. That division may be even more palpable on Native lands, where outside exploitation has a long and ugly history, and where technology companies see a chance for rapid development that gets past the red tape impeding projects elsewhere. The National Congress of American Indians wants to capitalize on the Trump administration's AI action plan to build, baby, build. Tribal lands, which are vast, strategically located, and home to an eager American workforce, are the ideal place to build the infrastructure that will power America's AI dominance, wrote Larry Wright Jr., the Congress's executive director, to the White House last fall. Siobhan Cornell, a tribal council member for the Seminole Nation, rejected what he called the false fruits of wealth that conjure painful memories. True wealth is the well-being of our families, he said during a tour of his family cemetery an hour east of Oklahoma City. True wealth is being able to live on this earth, Mother, without fear and without having to look over one's shoulders. Last fall, at the National Congress's annual conference in Seattle, activists interrupted an AI panel by chanting, "You can't drink data," and "The biggest lie is AI." Tracy L. Morris, executive director of the American Indian Policy Institute at Arizona State University, was on stage and was reminded of when the federal government expanded broadband access to reservations in 2010. "There were tribes that were like, no, we're never going to go on the internet," said Morris, a member of Oklahoma's Chickasaw Nation. Well, data centers are here, and tribes need to make a decision. The issues have cropped up on Indian lands nationwide. In the Pacific Northwest, the Yakama Nation went to federal court in May to block a clean energy project on a sacred site that would power a data center campus. Honor the Earth, a national indigenous group, has kicked off a Stop Data Colonialism campaign featuring an interactive map tracking proposed data centers. But Oklahoma, which has 38 federally recognized tribes, is really ground zero, Morris said. Among the reasons tech companies find tribal land so appealing is speed, according to the Payne Institute of Public Policy at the Colorado School of Mines. While energy projects on non-tribal lands can face permitting delays of 3 to 10 years, projects on tribal land often proceed more quickly because tribes wield sovereign authority to handle their own regulations and permitting. But many tribal leaders are in no rush. Cornell was in Washington, D.C. on business when his wife texted in February to see if he had noticed the very last agenda item at the next Seminole Council meeting, approving a non-disclosure agreement with a data center developer. "There was no consultation and no conversation," Cornell said, "so he hastily organized a town hall that drew dozens of opponents from inside the tribe and outside. Days later, the council, with Colonel on it, unanimously passed a data center moratorium, the first tribe to do so." Last year, after intense opposition, the Council of the Muscogee Nation, 40 miles south of Tulsa, rejected rezoning 5,570 acres from agriculture and meat processing to business for a technology park. Jordan Harmon, a Muscogee lawyer and policy specialist for the Indigenous Environmental Network, pointed to Honor the Earth's Stop Data Colonialism manifesto that is completely anti-AI, specifically generative AI, developed by big tech. But that's where the community sometimes is in conflict or butting heads with tribal leadership, she said. Now, with all eyes on the influential Cherokees, the country's most populous tribe with 480,000 enrolled members, and whose 7,000 square mile reservation is almost the size of New Jersey.
The tall ships return in all their majestic glory. Just as the World Cup wraps up in Boston, the tall ships will sail into our midst. Starting Saturday, a fleet of more than 50 international and military sailing vessels representing more than 20 countries will make port around Boston to celebrate the United States' 250th anniversary. The event, called Sail 250, will kick off with a grand parade of sail and offer many opportunities to board and tour the majestic ships. Festivities began with a ceremonial welcome on Friday morning at the Boston Harbor Hotel. But the real show is Saturday, when the tall ships sail into Boston Harbor, visible along waterfronts from South Boston to Charlestown to East Boston, morning and afternoon before docking around the city. Have questions about the big event? We have answers. First, what are tall ships? Tall ships, or traditionally rigged multi-masted sailing vessels, come in various shapes and sizes, and Sail Boston 2026 will feature all kinds, from large barks to graceful schooners and small pinnaces. Boston hasn't hosted the tall ships since 2017, though much of this year's fleet has routes around Massachusetts and New England, with more than a dozen ships hailing from ports from Gloucester to Provincetown. The USS Constitution, which will lead the parade, has its permanent home in Charlestown. Sail Boston organizers said they expect about 4 million people to turn out at the events, which run through Wednesday. The ships sailed to Boston from New York City, where they celebrated July 4th. New Orleans, Norfolk, Virginia, and Baltimore hosted the ships in May and June. Where can I watch Saturday's Parade of Sail? Saturday's main event, the Meet Boston Parade of Sail, runs from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., but Inner Harbor spectators shouldn't expect to see the ships until about 10:15 a.m. That's when the first flotilla, led by the USS Constitution with a naval jet flyover, is expected to pass spectators on Castle Island, according to David Choate, Vice President of Conventures Incorporated, the event's planner. That first group of tall ships arrives at a turnaround point near Charlestown by 10:30 a.m., Choate said, and will dock nearby at Charleston Navy Yard shortly after. From 10:45 to 3:45 p.m., flotillas of ships will pass through the Inner Harbor every 15 minutes, offering parade views from South Boston, Seaport, and the downtown Boston waterfront to East Boston and Charlestown. The ships will dock at berths around the city, with the last ship expected at Boston Fish Pier at 4:15 p.m., Choate said. The two largest ship ports will be the Charlestown Navy Yard and downtown Boston's Fan Pier Park, housing 18 and 9 ships, respectively. Saturday's flotillas begin their entrance to Boston Harbor from roughly 6 miles offshore, so bring up binoculars, pair of binoculars, if you're planning to catch them early at Castle Island. Here are all the free areas where you can catch a glimpse on Saturday. South Boston, Castle Island, 2010 William J. Day Boulevard, Massport Marine Terminal, 5th Kennedy Avenue, Seaport, Van Pier Park, 1 Courthouse Way, Commonwealth Pier, 200 Seaport Boulevard. In East Boston, Navy Fuel Pier, 325 Marginal Street, Pierce Park, 95 Marginal Street, East Boston Pier 1, home of the Tall Ships Bar. View from the onboard bar is ticketed, 1 East Pier Drive, Lopresti Park, 33 Summer Street, downtown Boston Waterfront, Lewis Wharf, Christopher Columbus Park and Long Wharf, 100 Atlantic Avenue, Charlestown, Menino Park, 98 16th Street, Boston, Charlestown Navy Yard, Piers 4 and 6, 1st Avenue and 3rd Street. Spectators can also watch for free from the Institute of Contemporary Art's Waterfront Grandstand and tour the museum free of charge on Saturday. The ICA is also selling tickets to a paid viewing lounge on its back plaza, including brunch and an open bar. Other ticketed viewing options like grandstand seating at Boston Fish Pier have sold out. You may also watch the parade from your own boat in designated harbor areas. Can I board the ships? Yes. All ships are available for boarding and free self-guided deck tours beginning Saturday from 5 p.m. until 10 p.m. From Sunday through Wednesday, July 15th, ships will have free boarding hours between 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. All hours and boarding times may vary at the captain's discretion. Can I go below deck? No, most tours are on deck only, but ship crews will be present during tour hours to greet guests. Some vessels may later allow for below-deck visits, but those details are not yet available, Choate said. A few ships also offer day sailing tours and events like firework cruises at extra cost. What other events are there? Sail Boston is hosting a free festival for all ages near the Seaport's Leaders Bank Pavilion, open Saturday to Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., no registration required. There'll be a Ferris wheel, a Sam Adams beer garden, concessions, merch, and the chance to meet the Tall Ships International Sailing Crews. Leader Bank Pavilion also marks the starting point of a street parade on Monday featuring 1,000 Tall Ships sailors and crew members. It starts at noon and ends at 2 p.m. at Christopher Columbus Park. There's also the Sail Boston Cup, a 5-on-5 soccer tournament at Lopresti Park in East Boston on Tuesday. Navy ship crews and cadets from multiple countries will face off from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And if all that's not enough, fireworks displays are scheduled for 9:15 p.m. Saturday and Wednesday near Boston's Fan Pier. What should I bring? It'll be sunny and warm on Saturday for the parade of sail, so be sure to wear sunblock and bring some water. Solid walking shoes are also a good bet if you plan to visit multiple docks or viewing locations throughout the day, many of which are accessible by following the harbor walk. Castle Island spectators may also want to grab a beach chair, blanket, and umbrella, but you're also allowed in viewing area and on event piers. Handheld, non-wheeled coolers are also allowed, as are food and drinks, though glass bottles and premix or alcoholic beverages are not, according to Sail Boston. What should I leave at home? There'll be no bag storage at the event, so pack light. Small purses and bags are allowed, but backpacks are prohibited in all ships and event areas. Pier access points and watch locations will have security checkpoints. Bikes, electric scooters, wheeled coolers, pop-up tents, drones, and fireworks are banned on piers and event spots while the tall ships are here. While baby strollers are allowed, wagons and pull carts are not. Also, leave your pets at home. How can I get there? MBTA officials have urged visitors to take public transit rather than drive to events, and there will be increased subway line service in addition to shuttle buses. Fared bus service will run from JFK UMass Red Line stop to Castle Island and from Sullivan Square Station to Charleston Navy Yard every 5 to 10 minutes starting at 7 a.m. on Saturday. Castle Island shuttles end at 4 p.m. and Charleston bus service ends at 6 a.m. Additional free shuttle bus will run through South Boston every 30 minutes, ferrying spectators between South Boston Neighborhood House and South Boston Catholic Academy, and from A Street at Congress Street to the Laboure Center at Catholic Charities Boston, according to a release from the Massachusetts Port Authority. Massport is also hosting a free public viewing at Massport Marine Terminal in Seaport.
Trump's Vatican defender walks a diplomatic tightrope. Envoy balances ties, but loyalty remains intact. To the world, it has seemed clear for months that President Trump has been fighting with Pope Leo the 14th about the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, which the Pope has said is not just a war. But to the president's man at the Vatican, that narrative is simply false and entirely unfair. In fact, the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See, Brian Birch, would go so far as to say that the Pope, the firstborn in the United States, has not even declared the war unjust. The Vatican has not said, nor will they say, declare definitively whether or not this is a just or an unjust war, he said during a 90-minute interview from his office in Rome in late June. Yet, on a flight to Spain weeks earlier, the Pope spoke plainly. I believe this has already been made very clear. In Iran, the criteria for a just war are not present, Leo said. To Birch, declaring the Iran war unjust is not a judgment the Pope can make, because he has access to only a set of limited facts. An ambassador's job is always part ceremony, part policy, and inevitably there are differences between countries that the diplomat must help navigate. But Birch is in an unusual spot. Leo is no typical head of state who deals simply in temporal politics. He is the world's most prominent religious leader, attending to the moral lives of 1.4 billion Catholics, including Birch. A longtime conservative Catholic activist, Birch also navigates the relationship between the two most prominent American men in the world, a popular pope and a bellicose president who have sharply diverging visions of global leadership. Birch has made clear his fealty to Trump, even as the president publicly derided the Pope on the social media, and Vice President J.D. Vance questioned the theology of the leader of the Catholic Church. I have never once thought for a second that somehow I couldn't properly represent the president, Birch said, adding that he believes the president and the Pope share goals that are very much aligned. An American pope is a unique opportunity for the United States, but he said that fundamentally, the policies and leadership of President Trump are an enabling a moment for the Catholic Church to both grow and thrive. At times, Birch believes the Vatican has failed to understand Trump's agenda. After the Defense Department invited Cardinal Christophe Pierre, the Vatican's ambassador to the United States at the time, to a rare meeting at the Pentagon in January, reports spread that U.S. officials had threatened the Vatican for its position on the war in Iran. The meeting was grossly mischaracterized, Birch said. Birch presumed a leak had likely come from the Vatican side. The story was largely an attack on the United States, he said. So he called Pierre to ask for an apology and to help identify who was lying about the meeting. Then he posted a statement saying that Pierre emphatically denied the reports and that the Vatican also confirmed that details of the meeting had been exaggerated. Pierre did not respond to a request for comment. Trump nominated Birch, who had been the president and co-founder of Catholic Vote, a political advocacy group which helped him win key states like Pennsylvania in the 2024 election. Birch's confirmation as ambassador was a symbol of the rising strength of the conservative Catholic movement in America. He and his wife have 9 children, and like Leo, he lived in the Chicago area. Birch's views on the president have evolved over time. Catholic Vote did not support Trump in 2016, citing concerns over his moral judgment, but it had reversed course by 2020. In Birch's book, A New Catholic Moment, Donald Trump and the Politics of the Common Good, he wrote, "Donald Trump is Catholic's best choice, perhaps our only choice." Over 2 interviews in the past 2 weeks, Birch sometimes deployed his own Trump-like rhetorical flourishes. "This is such a mischaracterization that somehow the president seeks war," he said. "The last thing the president wants to do is go to war." But at a time when the Pope is one of the few world leaders who can openly criticize the president without fear of economic or military reprisals, Birch also suggested that the president wanted the Pope's moral approval. "When the Holy Father speaks, people pay attention," Birch said.
Les Bleus on the cusp of reliving the dream. Nobody thought they'd ever win it until they won it in 1998. Even playing at home, the challenge France's soccer team faced, L'Equipe's headline said, was like climbing Everest and Espadrille. So when Les Bleus blanked defending champion Brazil to hoist the World Cup for the first time, they thought it was pour l'éternité. Once you'd reached the summit in straw shoes, did you have to scale it again? Across the decades, the French have been whipsawed between le rêve, the dream, and le cauchemar, the nightmare, when it comes to la Coupe du Monde. They lived the dream twice now, winning again in 2018. They've been jarred awake by the nightmare twice too, losing the final to Italy in 2006 and Argentina in 2022, both times in penalty shootouts. Now the dream is within reach again after France smothered Morocco 2-0 in Thursday afternoon's quarterfinal to advance to next week's semifinal. "It's confirmation for us for what we have displayed so far," said coach Didier Deschamps, whose squad will face Friday's Spain-Belgium victor. The French, who beat the Atlas Lions by the same score 4 years ago in the semifinals, know that they'd have to sweat again for this one. After their early dismissals of Senegal, Iraq, Norway, and Sweden, when they were scoring goals in triplicate, Les Bleus had to go 70 minutes with Paraguay in the round of 16 before Kylian Mbappé scored on a penalty. They knew Morocco would be at least as tough a nut to crack. In the knockout rounds 4 years ago, the Atlas Lions eliminated Spain in a shootout and Portugal with keeper Yacine Bounou posting a pair of clean sheets. This time, they drew with Brazil in their group opener and expelled the Dutch in a shootout. But with star striker Ismaël Sabari sidelined with a hamstring injury, the Moroccans essentially were performing on one leg against France. "We left them no chance to be dangerous to us," Deschamps said. Yet Les Bleus still had to score, and when Bounou blocked Mbappé's penalty bid in the 28th minute, the gas could be heard from Calais to Casablanca. The Atlas Lions managed to hang in for an hour until France deftly cracked them like a clay couscous pot with 2 goals in a half a dozen minutes. The first came from Mbappé, who saw an opening no longer than a baguette between a defender and the right post and hammered the ball through it in the 60th. Then he fed fleet sideskip Ousmane Dembélé, who went with authority to the far corner in the 66th, and France was through to the final 4. "We have to recognize that it's a great team," said Moroccan coach Mohamed Ouabi. "We have to accept this defeat." The expectation among their Bleu Blanc Rouge countrymen is that France will always play in the final. In 1998, when Deschamps was captain, he said that winning the cup would be a bonus. The Brazilians, who'd won 4 by then, felt otherwise and were devastated to lose. Once the dream has been made real and it can no longer remain a dream, anything less than another trophy is a letdown. What Les Bleus have come to understand is that l'éternité means that the expectations are eternal as well. When Brazil and Germany departed early from the tournament, the question from their disillusioned and disgusted followers was the same. What the hell happened? That would have been the reaction back home had France fallen to Morocco. Matches against former colonies always are particularly stressful. The French lost to newbie Senegal in their 2002 opener when they came in as reigning champions and went 3-0 after a loss to Denmark. Who let the frogs out? Tipsy Danish fans sang. Last time, France was shut out by Tunisia in their group finale, and Les Bleus had to work hard against Senegal in their opener this time. Beating Morocco was an absolute imperative. Now that the French again are 2 victories in the cup, it's an occasion for the familiar Gallic inquietude. Spain edged them 2-1 in the European semifinals 2 years ago and went on to win the championship. Argentina, of course, broke French hearts last time. What if it's England in the final and not Argentina? The French can't imagine losing to a country that overcooks its roast beef. And now they've got a third trophy in sight, they can't imagine losing at all. The players understand that being on the team is a duty, Deschamps said.
From the opinion page, America's oldest habit, fearing the stranger. Americans whose families once fled hunger, persecution, and poverty now cheer policies that punish people escaping similar suffering. By Roland Merlot, who was the author of 21 novels and 7 books of nonfiction. I recently spent time in Ireland and Italy, 2 places from which millions of immigrants came to the United States, many of them settling in Boston. I have a blood connection to both countries, an Irish great-grandmother on my mother's side and an Italian grandparents on my father's. And I know from family lore and historical reading that neither group enjoyed a particularly warm reception when they reached these shores. But walking the streets of Dublin and Rome, I couldn't help thinking about the hunger and hardship that compelled my ancestors to leave everything familiar to them and risk the transatlantic crossing, and the mockery and mistreatment that greeted them when they arrived. And I couldn't help thinking about immigrants who fled similar hardships during my own lifetime, escaping violence and deprivation in places like El Salvador, Venezuela, Haiti, and Syria, and now who confront an even crueler American welcome than what my people faced. I was in Europe in June when Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Defense, delivered a speech at the D-Day commemoration where he compared recent waves of immigration to the invasion and occupation by Nazi forces during World War II. A few days later, I read that the federal government sent an Iranian woman who had fled repression to her home country to, of all places, the Central African Republic, which the State Department lists as one of the most dangerous countries on earth. Add to those events Immigration and Customs Enforcement heartless arrests and deportations, the inhumane conditions reported at its detention centers, and the mistreatment of some players and referees arriving for the World Cup soccer matches. And then you have a new list of exhibits in a museum of American cruelty that already has rooms which could be titled Treatment of Natives, The Horror of Slavery, The Refusal of Jews Fleeing Hitler, The Internment Camps, Sexism, Homophobia, and on and on. All those sins have their roots in the same poisonous soil, fear of the other. That fear flourishes among people who've never had the courage to step away from the emotional and psychological environment in which they were raised. There is a term in Italian, campanilismo, which refers in both positive and negative ways to the feeling of belonging to a particular place and culture, and stems etymologically from the idea of never having traveled beyond the sound of one's local campanile, or bell tower. I happened to be in Dublin on June 16th, the date on which James Joyce's masterful novel Ulysses takes place. Joyce once said, "It is dangerous to abandon one's own country, but it is more dangerous still to return to it, for then your fellow countrymen, if they can, will drive a knife into your heart." He was talking about his troubled relationship with Ireland, a place he abandoned at age 22 and returned to only infrequently and briefly thereafter. But the quote can also be read as describing the negative side of campanilismo, as a criticism of provincialism, a comment on how fiercely we cling to what we know and how we view with suspicion those who venture into new territory. The most ardent Trump supporters in my circles of acquaintance, those who rail most virulently against the invasion of immigrants, have never, ever stepped very far out of their comfort zones. I don't mean people who haven't vacationed abroad, Travel, especially overseas travel, is a luxury beyond the reach of millions of Americans. I mean people, like those who might have knifed Joyce for leaving his homeland, have never considered the subjectivity of their own preferences. People who believe that their skin color, language, religion, sexual preference, cuisine, ethnicity, national flag, and culture are obviously superior to every other. That MAGA attitude, given a stamp of approval by high officials like Trump and Hegseth, betrays not only a deep-seated fear of difference, but also an immense conceit, nurtured by ignorance that cloaks itself in the guise of patriotism. The painful irony here is that if the ancestors of such people had shared that fear, they would have stayed in Ireland or Italy or any of the other places from which brave souls left everything they knew and came to America looking for better. What kind of nation would we have had then? That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to the Talking Information Center. I'm Pam.
And Pamela.
Have a great weekend.
These are the death notices from Friday, July 10th, 2026. From Arlington, Beverly Ketchin. From Belchertown, Beverly Ketchin. From Boston, Herman Chernoff, Donald J. Clemente, Beverly Ketchin, and Richard A. Negro. From Brewster, David Joseph Gilmartin. From Brookline, Mayor Rabinowitz. From Cambridge, Beverly Ketchin. From Dorchester, David Joseph Gilmartin. From Everett, Richard A. Negro. From Higham, Richard A. Negro. From Malden, Jean Philip Rava. From Medford, Lee W. Enos and Beverly Ketchin. From Newton, Loretta Ann Kendig. From Nonatum, Loretta Ann Kendig. From Rockland, Richard A. Negro. From Twerksbury, Lee W. Enos. From Weymouth, Richard A. Negro. And from Winchester, Lee W. Enos. This concludes the death notices for today.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies, because when people don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, they can truly thrive, like Marta.
And now we'll hear from our class valedictorian, who with her hard work never ceases to amaze us. Please welcome Marta Moreno.
And Alex.
How did the interview go?
I did it! I got the job! I can't believe it!
I knew it. Let's meet up later to celebrate.
And Diego.
Mom! I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project!
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations!
Because when people are fed, futures are nourished, and everyone deserves to live a full life. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. feedingamerica.org/act now. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party? You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our quinces. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov.